The Buddhist Summer School, 1976. Firoz Mehta's talk on the naming of the angels and devas, given on Wednesday afternoon, the 1st of September.
We considered the other day the meaning of the word conception in its transcendental sense. Let me just repeat it in order to refresh our memories. When there is an upsurge of creative energy, it falls back on itself, thereby creating its own container. Thus, this creative energy, contained within its own container, self-contained in other words, is the original conception out of which all other conceptions, meaning thereby the activities of creative energy, proceed. Now, we human beings, if and as we develop along certain lines which bring into prominence dormant sensitivities and potentialities of the mind, begin to be aware, to sense these creative energies which function in certain main ways, what we call the great archetypal forces come into being. These archetypal energies or forces receive names. They are the names of the archangels and angels, the suras and the asuras, the constructive agencies and the destructive agencies of nature, and so on and so on. Now we must bear clearly in mind that these are the names given by you and me, human beings. And the names we give are necessarily names which have been conditioned by our own culture, our history, our particular modes of perceiving and understanding. But by and large, you will find correspondences throughout the great religions of the world. Just as you have archangels and angels and so on in the Judeo-Christian tradition, so too in Zarathustrianism, they were presented in Iran as the six great attributes of Ahura Mazda, the original creative power. And of course in Hinduism in particular, you find innumerable divisions and classifications and so on. To start with, there are the great gods of the Rig Veda. Then there are proliferations from 7 to 12, and then running into hundreds and thousands proceeds. There's one very delightful discourse between Yajnavalkya and one of his Brahmin questioners in the Upanishads. And the questioner asks Yajnavalkya, how many gods are there? And Yajnavalkya says 3,303. Yes, yes, says the Brahman. How many gods are there? 300. Yes, yes, how many gods are there? 3. And then he proceeds, how many gods are there, Yajnavalkya? 1.5. And he finally comes back to 1. Now the Upanishads are not always explicit and explanatory. They leave out a great deal. These Upanishads were like shorthand notes, just little jottings of the important points given out by the teachers. So you just get this statement, 3,303 down to 1.5 and ultimately back to the 1. But do remember that these conversations between those supreme yogis, like Yajnavalkya, who was called Prince of Yogis, Yogeshwara, and the great Brahmins who came to him, these conversations were really transmissions of mind, afterwards given verbal form for the benefit of those disciples who had not reached that stage where mind directly communicated with mind and raised, and the two minds fused and were raised into profounder and profounder states of awareness. We must remember that. Now to come back to these names, in Buddhism too we have various names, the Dhyani Buddhas for instance, and so on. And the Buddha himself, in his personal discourses, he often uses two or three names, Indra, Inda, as he says in Pali, Prajapati, which is Prajapati, and Sakra, which is another name for Indra, actually. You see, the chief of the gods. Now, these names are different in the different cultures. And their meanings, therefore, also have certain slight differences from the meanings in other cultures. But the names are determined, as I said earlier, by our own conditioning. What happens in consequence of that? As the tradition is passed on, the names remain, and before long they are anthropomorphized in the minds of the listeners. So Michael and Uriel, Sephariel and all the others, you see, Gabriel and so on, they become winged creatures with golden halos flying through the atmosphere and so on, obeying the commands of the Most High. The spiritual hierarchy, in short, is in the image of the prevailing earthly hierarchy in that culture. Then curious ideas come into being. Because the few, the perfected holy ones, do touch these transcendental heights and plumb the transcendental depths, they do get into touch with this ultimate creative power as such, and can be aware of them and treat them as unknown and unknowable powers. The common people, having done this, having created their own spiritual hierarchy out of their own brains, they postulate that the material world which we see and experience is a replica, a shadow, a poor expression of this perfect divine hierarchy and spiritual world. This is not the case. It is the other way around. The entire spiritual hierarchy, God and his archangels and angels and everything, comes out of your brain and my brain, functioning in its own particular conditioned way, subject to all that conditioning and limitation, but presented in apotheosis because people want something to reverence and worship. It is a case of the subtlest type of self-identification with the Supreme. It is the supreme expression of egoism, without our knowing it. This is where the Buddha performed a service of inestimable value when it is put in the discourses that he meets with all these ladies and gentlemen of the spiritual world and converses with them and talks with them, and in several cases tells them outright, I am greater than you, you don't know these things and so forth. He's quite right. And what's interesting, of course this is the Buddhist record naturally, you see, what is interesting is that the gods do obeisance unto the Buddha. But that is right, essentially right. He who has liberated, who has become liberated from thraldom to the ultimate concepts possible for any person in any particular culture, he is certainly free of all compulsion or fear or wrong relationship with respect to the gods, which are only man's own mental projections. And this is a very important point to bear in mind. If we can really understand it, innumerable fears, innumerable questions as to what I should do, how shall I proceed, what particular technique shall I follow, prayer or meditation or contemplation or samadhi or anything you like, all those questions would vanish. Because if you understand this, then your power to turn the inward light upon yourself, as I read from Hui Ming yesterday, to turn that inward light upon yourself has grown within you. And in that light, all the gods stand revealed in shining array. Obedient to you, their creator. That is how it is. Now, the very important point we must bear in mind here is this. We are thralls of our concepts. We talk easily about archetypal energies and forces. Just let us remember the essential points in this connection. You and I, if and when, in the deep states of meditation, these dormant sensitivities wake up and we sense the play of transcendent energies, then we are aware of something real, perfectly real, functioning through time and space as long as you and I have discriminative consciousness, vijnana. It is due to vijnana that our universe is seen, understood, experienced, explained as a space-time universe. A space-time universe. And these archetypal energies, influence the whole of the mind, especially all that we commonly call the subconscious and unconscious parts of ourselves. And these archetypal energies respond to us as and when we pray or meditate. If we pray or meditate in supplication, the archetypal energies will just respond. Just as if you turn on an electric switch, the electric current will flow. But unless everything is properly connected and the receiving end, say a bulb, is the right sort of bulb, what will happen? There will be an explosion, something will break up, something will give way. So when you pray to the gods, even when you offer up simple homage to the gods, use the word gods in its liberal sense, beware of the consequences. What you pray for may not be granted you in the form you desire it ought to be granted. You are playing with archetypal energies. Relate this to the Buddha's teaching to be totally free of all grasping. In the third volume of the Majjhima, one of the early discourses, you'll find the Buddha talking to Ananda and saying, "But, O Ananda, the monk who is completely free of all grasping, he realizes deathlessness. He attains nirvana." That's how it is translated, that he attains nirvana. I always put it the other way around. Nirvana suffuses him and shines through him, the non-grasping one. Because to grasp these transcendental energies, you'd have to have a super insulation to escape being exterminated by them. And if you have a super insulation, where is the communion? You are separated from. So, this realization of nirvana, this eternal light which shines in the darkness, although it is subsumed by the dark, which illuminates the darkness, depends upon our non-grasping. Thus we begin to see the tremendous importance of the Buddha's teaching with regard to mindfulness. This is shape, this is form, it is anicca. And do remember, anicca means not only just impermanent, meaning that it will perish, it also means the relative, the conditioned. Whatsoever is relative is conditioned by that to which it is related. See, it is relative, it is conditioned, it is impermanent, it is perishing, it is changing. Not to be relied upon, not to be leaned upon for support, because it will fall down someday and you with it. You see? So, shape or form is anicca, and anicca is the opposite linguistically of nitya, the eternal, the absolute. Nitya is the absolute, but the absolute subsumes the not absolute. The changing, the dying is all subsumed in this absolute, immortal, immeasurable, totally beyond our knowing and knowability. These are very important things to realize. Do not grasp at any feeling, whether it be pleasant, painful, or neutral, the neutral state. The state of neutrality does not mean a deadly, dull, dry, state at all. Remember, Upekkha was presented as the peak point from Metta, Karuna, Mudita, and finally Upekkha. See? Do not grasp that. Do not grasp at sannyā, thoughts, ideas, thought forms, and so on. At sankhara, at discriminative consciousness itself. Because if you grasp that discriminative consciousness, here I will use the word which is usually used in translation, there will be no escape out of this dualizing, multiplicity-making power of our consciousness and becoming one with, totally one with, the unitary whole awareness. That is why. The Buddha did present the unitary whole awareness. In the Digha you'll find it, in the long discourses, as well as in the middle-length sayings, the Majjhima. Vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato paham or pabham. The characterless, the infinite, the shapeless, formless, the absolute, the unending, undying, therefore unborn, sabbato, everywhere, accessible or shining. This is the Buddha's statement, which is the equivalent, the exact equivalent of the Upanishadic Atma. People talk very unhappily about the Atma and all this business. They just don't know what they are talking about. They don't take even the trouble to study the original Upanishads and see what was taught about them. To give you one example, the Varaha Upanishad, which is not one of the earlier Upanishads, but a later Upanishad, the Varaha Upanishad gives a wonderful statement about the Atma. It says that the Atma, which is identical with Brahman, and both terms were used to represent ultimate reality, is the unconditioned, the absolute, the all-shining. How different is that from the Buddha's unborn, unbecome, unmade? From the Buddha's affirmation in that autobiographical discourse, seeking the unborn, seeking the unaging, the undecaying, the undying, the stainless, the sorrowless, I sought it and won it. That's how it is put in the Pali text. Is it different? In the Chandogya Upanishad, Prajapati tells Vairochana and Indra, the Atma, which is unborn, which is undying, unaging, unsorrowing, which is utterly pure, is that which should be sought. And precisely that is what the Buddha himself says he sought, the unborn, the unaging, the undying, etc. So we must appreciate this point. Atma also has another meaning. I came to the meaning myself some years ago, around about 1969. And of course, still being a very ordinary mortal, I experienced a little delight and conceit in the wonderful discovery. Years later I discovered that Shankaracharya had said the same. And I never knew it. The Atma is the eater up of the mind. The eater up of the mind. Very interesting way of putting it. I won't go into the explanation yet. Actually, you'll find it in my book towards the very end, this business of Atma, Brahman, and so on. Now, therefore, no grasping at anything whatsoever, including discriminative consciousness. Now, if one even begins to have a glimmer of all that is implied in this, one experiences the state of freedom. And one knows that whatsoever the mind conceives and speaks of, whatsoever the mind gives shape to and form, is not the reality. The names of the archangels and angels and so forth, of Indra and Prajapati and all the rest of them, are not the reality of Gabriel or Michael or Soma or Varuna or Agni or any of Avalokiteshvara or any of the gods and goddesses and the Dhyani Buddhas and so on. But unfortunately, we being limited and simple humans, and because we anthropomorphize, we seize hold of the name and we have a mental construct in our minds associated with that name. And so we endow our gods and our deities, whether they be big deities or small deities or any sort of deities, with all sorts of qualities and powers and so on, with which we are acquainted in the world. That is not the truth. These archetypal energies we sense, true enough, in the profound and deep states, we sense them, but refrain from clothing them with our rags. This is very important. And if the mind is kept pure, asking for nothing, alert, awake, then those archetypal energies will function through you and do for you what you yourself by your own efforts cannot do. It's a little bit similar to Hercules cleaning out the Augean stables. You remember? One of the labors of Hercules was to clean out the Augean stables. Hercules was a man god, the son of Zeus and Alcmene immortal, the king of Olympus, an archetypal figure, the lord of Olympus. He is the correspondent of Indra in the Rig Vedic pantheon, you see. He's the son of Zeus and Alcmene, obviously a very charming Greek lady, you see. And one of the tasks set him was to clean out the Augean stables. He has one look at the stables, and this Greek man god, a sort of a correspondent of the Teutonic Siegfried, knew with the perception of the innocent childlike mind, I can't do that thing. So he just turned the course of a river, and the river cleaned out the stables. How many buckets would he have had to carry to clean out those stables? Now, the archetypal forces can function through us that way. But their functioning is completely dependent upon our being pure. and our being selfless. If we ask anything for ourselves, and this asking, do remember, is not confined to the conscious mind. Our secret hidden desires in the deepest recesses of our minds, we have to be watchful that they too are put to sleep first. See why it is said, do not attempt to storm the ramparts of heaven. You will only find hell that way. Do not demand from God daily bread, spiritual sustenance. Do not demand it. But in meekness and humility, offer thanks. And the immeasurable beneficence will pour out its infinite bounty upon you. It's extraordinary how that functions. I'm using the word God to represent that which is transcendent. You might just as well use the word Buddha or any word you like. But try and get away from the word and thrall them to the word. Now, if we can do this, what happens in relation to our predispositions and our predilections for any particular religious formulation? It raises up the great question of why be a Buddhist? Why turn to Christianity? Why turn to Islam or Zarathustrianism or Hinduism or Vedanta? Why? The answer always is, it suits me better. I have a natural affinity for this. Of course the answer is correct. It does suit me better. Because I am so constituted. But go behind that reason and see that I am just acknowledging my limitation. That doesn't mean don't take to the thing which suits you better. By all means do. After all, for the health of the body, eat the food that really suits your body. And avoid the food that does your body harm. But the deeper thing for your for helping you to have a completely open mind is to realize that there is this limitation involved in the preference. And as long as we have preferential choice, instead of being aware and open without personal choice, as long as we have preferential choice, we will always bind ourselves and remain bound within that prison house. Before any one of us can stand in the presence of the Absolute, it's a strange statement to me, but you understand what I'm trying to say. Before any one of us can stand in the presence of the Absolute, we have to be utterly naked. Not only utterly naked, but utterly transparent. Which means that there is no special shape which is introduced as me to the Absolute. The knock at the door, the question, who is it? It is I, O Lord. Out you go. You see the meaning. This cleansing of the mind, this purification of the mind, is something which we have hardly begun to understand. Every day of my life, I wake up to the fact that I don't know anything really. I have to start from the beginning. I'm always at the beginning. And learning, learning, learning all the time. The mind and the heart. What a beautiful distinction Dr. Shlogal drew the other evening between the mind as ordinarily understood and recognized and the heart, the reality. The warm, living, creative aspect of this something which is transcendent, which is in us. And the mind as mind, especially with respect to its intellectual processes and faculties, is that which holds at a distance and looks. Just looks without being completely united with. But that is an indispensable first step. You have to be mindful. You have to look like that, dispassionately. Again and again, the Buddha stresses dispassion. And he saw that this did not conduce, amongst various other things, to dispassion, to nirodha, fading away. Fading away is the way it is translated. But I rather imagine that the Buddha may have meant becoming transformed. Not fading away, but a thing fades away and in our ordinary experience it is dead, it is finished with. That doesn't happen. Nothing is dead. Everything is transformed. This transformation keeps taking place in this state of dispassion, non-grasping. And why and how? Because where there is real non-grasping, there is communion. The communion which ultimately blossoms into the timeless conjugation of the fundamental positive, negative, creative forces of the universe. And in that state is the complete and utter fulfillment of the members of the species we call Homo sapiens. So, let us be awake to the power of names to hold us in subjugation. Let go the name. The name is not the thing. Only insofar as a name, the nomen in Latin, is the informing principle, the animating principle of any particular manifestation, is the name valuable. And you see, after the organism is dead, what survives? The name survives in the memory of others. And the survival of the name in the memory of others is in the shape of the individual person's own conditioning. When you say Buddha, when you say Buddha, when I say Buddha, they are all different Buddhas, not the Tathagata, the unfathomable, the deep, the crackless, the transcendent. You see what the name does? So the name survives. And long as the name is transmitted in human memory, we say that the Buddha lives. You know how Christendom talks in terms of the ascension of Jesus, triumphing over the grave and death. You see, he lives forever. They don't understand, Christendom doesn't understand when it believes it literally. That it is the name which lives in their memory. And because the individual memory is the memory, every individual's memory is the memory of one who is the victim of greed and hate and delusion and fear and confusion and all the rest of it. Therefore, the living reality which was Jesus is being continuously crucified. It's important to remember this. Therefore, through our practice of mindfulness in real earnest, let go all the veils, our mental constructs, our ideas, don't grasp them. An idea as it emerges from within, yes, that will be good in time and space just for its lifetime. And it's difficult to determine its lifetime. What we do is, any particular idea dies pretty soon, to tell you the truth. It dies pretty soon. What we do is to take that dead thing, bury it with due ceremonial and pomp and all the rest of it, and say, ah, oh, look, here is truth. Let us worship it. This is what we actually do. I've done it myself through my young years and in my middle age. And I always heard Puck say, Lord, what a fool this mortal is. Finally, when I said yes to him, he stopped pestering me. That is just the introduction so far. Now, let's see what some of the things that Hui Neng said. You remember, I read that passage where he explains the meaning of Maha, great. It is infinite, neither round nor square, long, short, and pointed out the parallel passage in the Upanishad, which precedes him by about 14 or 15 centuries. See? Now, here he says, we say that the essence of mind is great because it embraces all things, since all things are within our nature. When we see the goodness or the badness of other people, we are not attracted by it because of the realization of essence of mind, nor repelled by it, nor attached to it, so that our attitude of mind is as void as space. And in this connection, it is useful to remember that the void is something which is infinitely resilient. You can't hurt the void. You can't pierce it, you can't thrust it, you can't slice it, you can't pass on it, you can't do anything with it. It's utterly resilient. Consider the extraordinary fact. You take any object, and we commonly say, this object exists in space. All right, I remove this object. The space rush in to take, to fill up the void which is caused by the removal of this object. Space interpenetrates everything. This is the great mystery of space. It itself remains invisible, intangible, inaudible. Nothing which our senses, nothing which our subtler mental faculties can get hold of. And yet this mystery of this extraordinary thing called space, which interpenetrates every single object, and what's more, it is of such a nature that space will actually curve wheresoever there is a very dense collection of matter. That's how you get your black holes in space. The stars which are collapsing upon themselves. It's the same amount of matter there originally, but when it occupies a sufficiently small volume, the gravitative force becomes so great, and the curvature of space around it becomes so great, that not even light can escape from that star. So it becomes invisible. You don't know what's happening. Things are happening, of course, there, but we don't know. See? So this wideness of space, its extraordinary resiliency, and matter, as we experience it, is the warping of space. The wonderful thing Einstein did when he produced his general theory of relativity, as well as the special theory. Extraordinary thing. He's absolutely changed the whole course of man's thinking with that theory, combined, of course, with Max Planck's theories and Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. But let's not digress into that. Now, next. All prajna, insight, comes from the essence of mind and not from an exterior source. This is important. Now, do not think of the essence of mind as a something, as a specific something which can be separated. This is the trap we always fall into. My spirit, my soul, my atma, my essence of mind. That's all rubbish. There is no my about it at all. There is a functioning of energy which is incomprehensible by intellect. He says, so we must bear that in mind when we read that all prajna, insight, unerring insight, that is prajna. Don't translate it as intuition. It's an unfortunate word to use. Intuition can belong to a foolish person, to a confused person. You can have a hunch. Intuition is more related to that, to an animal sense in us, and not to this subtler, profounder, deeper, unerring perception. You see? That is prajna. That is the meaning of buddhi as used in the Upanishads and in Hindu, Vedanta and Hindu writings. Unerring insight. You see? Intuition is a little bit like a man just vaguely touching something, sense of touch. But this insight is, in addition to that touch, absolutely clear seeing with eyes that have no flaw. Get it? It's like that. That is prajna, panya, and buddhi. Have no, and Huinen goes on, have no mistaken notion about that. This is called self-use of the true nature. This functioning of pure insight. Once the suchness, the essence of mind, is known, one will be free from delusion forever.